GTD News. I'm Dave McGrath. It's 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Before we get to today's interview, we want to let you know that there has been a technical problem with WGTD's Morning Show archive on our website, WGTD.org. We were finally able to ascertain the problem first thing this morning. So all of the missing Morning Show entries on the Morning Show archive should be in place and ready to be listened to. So we apologize for the problem. Again, each and every Morning Show is archived on our website, WGTD.org. We are spending most of today's Morning Show talking about a really fascinating and also troubling book that has just been published called COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. This is a book that examines more than anything the way in which we made our way through the most difficult days of the COVID-19 pandemic, in which we ended up, of course, suffering a staggering number of deaths. And there are many ways in which according to my Morning Show guest, Ronald Gruner, we actually did quite badly, or at least did much worse than we perhaps should have, given the general state of our healthcare system and the amount of resources available to us, that nevertheless, America found itself in some very painful and counterproductive ways, highly divided, and that in many respects hobbled our ability to effectively respond to the devastating challenge of the COVID-19 pandemic. Thus, this really important book in which Ronald Gruner seeks to help us sort of re-examine what occurred and why, and what we might do to be perhaps better equipped to weather future challenges. Ronald Gruner has spent many years as a founder and CEO of three different technology companies. He has written a couple of different previous books, including We the Presidents. Again, this latest book is called COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. Ronald Gruner, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, good morning, Greg, and thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to our chat.
So I should think that anybody who wants to write about this particular moment in our recent history probably, at least to some extent, does so with a bit of trepidation, even if you feel strongly, as of course you do, that what you are writing about is important and needs to be said. But by its very nature, you are talking about a moment in our history. And it seems funny to call it our history because it was just the day before yesterday, in a sense. But you're talking about a moment when America was sharply divided, and we continue to be sharply divided in the way that we look on those events. Tell us about your own feelings as the author of this book as you approach this topic, and what in particular prompted you to want to take this on?
Well, initially I did not want to take it on. I mean, like most Americans, 2 or 3 years ago, I was anxious to move on from the pandemic, and I had finished the book, We the Presidents, and wasn't really interested in writing about COVID, but a number of my readers and friends suggested I really look carefully at the issue and try to look at it from the perspective of sorting out all the issues and trying to consider what was objective and what was more subjective and how that affected Americans. And so that was the approach I tried to take with the book when I started that 2.5 years ago. But also, I was surprised that it was 50 years after the 1918 Spanish flu, which your listeners may recall killed over 700,000 Americans, more than in World War One by a factor of three, that it was 50 years before the first book was written about the 1918 Spanish flu. And the name of the book was the Forgotten Influenza Pandemic. So I thought it would be useful to write a book shortly after the COVID pandemic and do that as objectively as I could to describe what happened and why it happened. And that's the basis of the book.
I think the question of timing is really intriguing because, of course, in many cases, something occurs and then books spring up nearly overnight like mushrooms. And in some cases, those books are written in such haste and without the benefit of, let's say, a longer view and perspective, hindsight, if you will, that those books end up being largely maybe worthless and forgotten. But clearly your book is not a book that was assembled in haste. You have done a great deal of research, and this is methodical work that you have done. Talk for a moment about the approach that you took to this, and also what it felt like to write this book now, at this point in time, when we are still not very far removed from most of the events that you describe.
Well, a couple of issues there. First is, you're right, there was dozens of books that came out within the first one or two years of the pandemic that I, in my introduction, describe as angry and accusatory. And if you go back and look at those now, they were largely based around conspiracy theories or misinformation that was floating around the country and even the world during the pandemic. What I tried to do was to build, first of all, my background, as you point out, is as an entrepreneur, but primarily I think of myself as an engineer, an electrical engineer. And in engineering, the mantra is data drives out speculation. So what I tried to do was to build a book based on hard data that people could verify and trust themselves. And I based most of that data around the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Now, I recognize that many people don't trust the federal government or their statistics. And I point out in my book, well, the CDC data is based on state data, which is then taken from the over 3,000 county health bureaus around the country. And what you can do as a reader, if you distrust that data, it's easy to confirm that the county data you have in your county is uploaded to the CDC accurately. And I did that, and I say this in my book, with about a dozen different counties around the United States, mostly in Massachusetts and Florida and Oklahoma, areas where I had homes at one point. And that data is accurate. So that was what I based the data around, and it showed that there were wide disparities in economic outturns, societal disruption, and, of course, death rates based on how people approach the pandemic in different parts of the country.
I want to give you a chance to explain something in the introduction to the book, when you not only in terms of where you drew your primary data from, as you just outlined, but then you say, to analyze the data, I relied on two simple statistical tools, correlation and extrapolation. For the sake of folks like me who are decently intelligent but not well-versed in the matter of statistics, explain the difference between correlation and extrapolation and why both are really essential to treating data like this carefully and beneficially.
Well, that's an excellent question, and I give you a good example. As I'm sure you know, during the pandemic, there were many claims that the number of COVID deaths were being badly exaggerated, and there weren't nearly that many deaths. And I recognized that concern. So what I did was I analyzed the total death rate in the United States from 2009 through 2019. And those deaths, averaging about 3.5 million deaths a year, increased very, very steadily over those 10 years, about 1.5% increase per year. It was like a straight line increase. So Then using the idea of extrapolation, you could say, okay, if deaths from 2009 to 2019 increased, let's say an average of 1.5% a year, year in and year out over 10 years, then in 2020, we can predict pretty accurately what we think the death rate should be. And what happened in 2020 was the deaths were about 450,000 more than projected on historical data. That's what's called extrapolation. So you have to ask yourself, well, I mean, why did all those people die? 450,000 more than expected. And the analysis says three-fourths, if not more than that, 80% died from COVID. So that was how you use extrapolation. Now, correlation is frankly, a little bit less reliable because it simply ties two events together. A rooster crows in the morning and the sun rises, but that doesn't mean the rooster is responsible for the sun rising, but the two events correlate. So when you use correlation, I don't mean to get too complicated here, you have to be careful about how you use it, and you have to try to stabilize other factors. So kind of the bottom line, if you look at the book, is whether you look at states, counties, or cities, those regions that had high vaccination rates invariably had lower COVID death rates. But that doesn't prove that vaccinations lowered death rates. So what I went then is I looked at areas that had similar characteristics in other areas like median age, income, education level, obesity levels, and I looked at counties that had things identical in those areas. Then I looked at the differences in vaccination rates and did that affect death rates? And yes, it did indeed. So I took out the variables that could have affected death rates other than vaccines and then analyzed that, and that was using correlation. That explanation is actually much more complicated than it actually is, and I try to clarify it in the book clearly, and I hope I did. But those are the two approaches I used, extrapolation and correlation.
You know, it's interesting, as you outlined that, it makes me realize, I mean, that one of the things that your book is about is misinformation or disinformation and conspiracy theories and so on. And, of course, in some cases, as your book explores, that is done quite deliberately. I mean, there is somebody who either does not want something to be true or wants the public to believe something else is true because that belief serves them somehow. And so, you know, we have deliberate usage of misinformation or disinformation. But as you outlined, the care with which you have tried to analyze these statistics, one realizes that it's also very possible to really inadvertently, I hesitate to use the word innocently, but one can also spread misinformation, disinformation, sometimes without even deliberately intending to do so, but by simply misunderstanding statistics, jumping to conclusions one way or another. I feel like your book does a great service to us right then and there, even beyond the central matter of the COVID pandemic, by maybe reminding all of us that statistics are a tool we have to approach so carefully. And most of us don't. Most of us don't even know how to do that.
Well, there are, you know, many common fallacies around statistics. I mean, for example, the common phrase that where there's smoke, there's fire. I mean, that's a correlation. Smoke and fire often correlate together, but not always. And so you do have to be careful about how you use statistics and what we oftentimes think of as just simply common wisdom, which is always not correct. What I tried to do to manage that, Greg, was that, as you know in my book, there's 120 pages of appendices. And, for example, every state, each of the 50 states has about two dozen statistics gathered from reliable sources. The reader who might be skeptical about my conclusions can go and look at that data. If they choose, they can confirm it's accurate and then begin to do a little bit of back envelope analysis themselves, for example. And I do the same thing for 20 developed countries because I draw conclusions about the United States versus other countries. So all the data that I used is in the back of the book. People can go and use if they have the energy to and the interest to confirm I was either right or wrong.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Ronald Gruner, who has written a book called COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. It is a book that examines, first of all, how the COVID-19 pandemic unfolded. I mean, essentially where it began, where it spread, how it spread, and then primarily America's response to this public health threat. And the book, of course, is, as much as anything, an indictment of the ways in which our response to this crisis overall was not what we might have hoped it to be in terms of efficiency and in terms of America forming, if you will, a united front against this really, really dangerous foe. Your book is laid out in quite meticulous fashion, and I think many will appreciate some of the long view historical record that you outline in the first chapter titled Contagion, in which, among other things, you kind of explore this whole notion of viruses and then specifically the coronavirus. And this is a longer story than I think most of us actually understand it to be.
Well, it's an interesting story, too. And knowing I was going to be using a lot of data and statistics in the book, I tried to blend in other aspects which people would find interesting and informative. And the discovery of viruses in the early 1890s during the Russian flu, which most people don't know, devastated well over a million people worldwide, conservatively estimated, was when viruses were first discovered. And the two scientists, one Russian and one Dutch, were astonished that they could pass the serum from tobacco plants, is where the virus came from, and it would pass through the finest filters, but it would still be infectious. So somehow it was getting through these tiny, tiny elements, much larger than bacteria, and they were confounded for years as to what that was until they realized they were dealing with something completely new to science, and that was a virus, much, much smaller than bacteria, and had to be dealt with in different ways. A bacteria can grow by itself. You put a bacteria in a laboratory, you can grow that by itself. A virus cannot. A virus must infect a living cell to replicate, which is different from bacteria. Then that was a fundamental change in science. So I talked about that, quite interesting. And then how viruses evolved from the, you know, going back hundreds of years, but actually first really hitting us very, very hard in 1918 with the Spanish flu, and how it evolved through the Asian flu in the 1950s, or the swine flu in the 70s, and SARS in the early 2000s, and then finally changed and became COVID in 2020. But all those viruses are first cousins to each other and related. They're just simply evolving over time, and one out of a million evolutions is fatal to humans. The others are benign, and they just keep evolving until something hits and becomes a pandemic.
Mm. I think we will have time later to circle back to this, but one of the things that I appreciate about the care with which your book has been written is that you do not seem inclined to make quick and easy connections between past events and more current events. So that, for instance, there are lessons to be learned from the devastating Spanish flu pandemic of 1918, but we have to be careful not to just take that event, which occurred in a certain landscape or environment, and then just sort of blindly apply it to what unfolded in 2020. There are lessons to be learned for sure, but we need to be careful about the way we draw those lessons. Can you just talk for a moment about that?
Well, that's a good point. Of course, in 1918, we didn't understand what we were dealing with. They had, although viruses were known and understood somewhat at the time, the 1918 Spanish flu was misinterpreted to be a bacterial infection, and they treated it as a bacterial infection, which was wrong. But we had many similarities between the pandemic in 2020 and 100 years earlier. The country was divided, not nearly so much as in COVID, but was divided about how to respond. For example, Philadelphia was a city which remained completely open during the height of the Spanish flu and had a death rate about five times higher than St. Louis did, just a few hundred miles to the west, which closed for several weeks at the height of the pandemic at the time and reduced their death rates. But people were mixed about that. For example, masks were mandated in a number of areas, and men who at the time cigar smoking was very popular would cut a hole in the mask so they could smoke a cigar as a way of protest. So there were also many similarities. But it was a difficult time for those in the war because in 1918, because they had just come out of the war, and then we had this horrible virus that was killing people at rates four times higher than the First World War.
Yeah. I must confess that my eyes kind of lit up a bit during the second chapter of your book, which is titled The Warning, which deals primarily with some of the concerns that then-President George W. Bush had about our country's preparedness for a future pandemic. And the reason for his concern would seem, more than anything, you tell us, is that he read a book called The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History by John Barry. I had the privilege of interviewing John Barry about that amazing book. And President Bush took that book in hand in the summer of 2005, not exactly light reading as you tell us, but he read that book with tremendous interest, and it really prompted him to try to move forward in terms of perhaps moving the needle in America's preparedness for any future such disaster. He was not entirely successful. Just say a quick word about President Bush's concerns around this and to the extent to which he acted on those concerns.
That history is one of the most commented aspects about my book that very few people realize, that George W. Bush, like you say, in 2005, recognized the risk that a pandemic would eventually hit the United States and that we must be prepared. And by 2006, he had convinced Congress to pass a bill authorizing $7 billion in spending to purchase medical supplies, masks, personal protection equipment, and everything else necessary to fight a pandemic. And then what happened was we had a number of smaller epidemics like Ebola, which we spent supplies to in Africa, the SARS and other epidemics in the United States, which depleted those supplies. So when those supplies were depleted by 2015 and Obama went back to Congress, Congress would not authorize it because we were in a spending freeze, and other senators felt, well, the risk of a pandemic is, yeah, I know it's real, but it's probably way in the distant future. We've got other things to worry about. So they did not reauthorize that spending. So in 2020, when President Trump said, rightly, that the shelves were empty, they were empty, but not because George W. Bush didn't anticipate there'd be an issue. But unfortunately, the Senate was too short-sighted to renew those funds 3 years before the pandemic, and we suffered from that.
Hmm. You also mentioned the fact that President Bush proposed that the federal government should enact policy to shield drug companies from litigation related to vaccines. And he had his reasons for doing so, perhaps defensible reasons, and yet, as you point out, this has been fuel for the fire for those who are skeptical about Big Pharma in general and vaccines in particular.
Well, that's true. That George W. Bush's notion there wasn't new. That had been done under the Reagan administration and then was diluted down, and Bush rejuvenated that indemnification of pharmaceutical companies. That is very, very controversial. I think the thinking was that it costs typically billions or millions, if not billions of dollars to develop a new vaccine, which may or may not be needed at the point if they do it in advance, which is ideally what they would do. And then if it doesn't work, they could be sued and put out of business. So they needed some kind of protection. Whether we've got the right balance or not, I don't know. People don't realize, though, if you do have a valid claim against injury by a vaccine, you can claim that with a government, and the government will reimburse you if they believe that's a valid claim. So there's a mechanism for being compensated for problems with vaccines, but it's through the government and not the pharmaceutical companies.
Right. One very intriguing matter that I knew absolutely nothing about before reading your book was a couple of instances in which early in the President Trump's first term, there there was work done on the matter of readiness for a pandemic. In particular, a really huge study that apparently was titled Crimson Contagion, that was quite an undertaking. And explain kind of the nature of this and why ultimately it did not prove to be as helpful as one might have hoped. And we should add that this is something that occurred, I believe, beginning in January of 2019, so more than a year ahead of the full onset of the COVID-19 pandemic.
That is absolutely correct. Alex Azar, who was a head of HHS, basically began that simulation of a worldwide pandemic in January of 2019, called Crimson Contagion. And that was the largest simulation of a pandemic ever conducted by the federal government. It was very thorough, very thoughtful. And it predicted, I forget the exact numbers, but predicted as many as 1.5 million Americans could die in that before a vaccine was developed. So that was a real eye-opener. And one of the good things that came out of that was that in September of 2019, President Trump authorized the spending of research dollars to develop a vaccine, an mRNA vaccine based on new technology to fight influenza virus. He did that six months before Operation Warp Speed. But unfortunately, many of the things that we learned during that simulation got set aside in 2020 when the government and industry and people overreacted and kind of lost sight of what that simulation taught us.
Mm. So your book then takes us in chapter three into what you call the beginning, and the way in which this first emerged. You tell us in late December, the first hints of an impending pandemic began to trickle out of China. And I think for those of us at least somewhat paying attention, there were certainly unsettling signs. How would you assess President Trump's administration, those charged with being watchful of such things, how would you gauge their response to the very first signs that something very, very serious might be afoot in China?
Well, the very, very beginning, as you might recall, President Trump shut down travel between China and the United States, and he was condemned for that, for being political and racist and other things. But that was a good thing to do. He was right about that during that at the end of January and early February, because we were beginning to see that virus trickling out of China. So that was smart. But I think I could summarize the president's policies and position around COVID during the first 6 months of the pandemic as being inconsistent. He'd swing from one extreme to the other, which confused people and was basically one of the problems we had setting a national policy
right.
from the pandemic early on.
If I can just jump in at one point in kind of talking about this, I mean, in terms of his widely differentiated comments on the topic. One day this is a terrible concern. The next day this is going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle, it will disappear, and so on. You say it was a confusing start to the worst healthcare disaster in a century. And I mean, there's nothing particularly alarming about those words on the page, but in fact, you're pointing to something incredibly dangerous. That is, confusion, in a sense, is the last thing you want at a point of looming crisis.
That's certainly true, and President Trump caused confusion. Dr. Anthony Fauci, I think he had the very best of intentions, but he did also. And so the first 6 months, and then of course we had the social media and the cable news, and as you know, in the beginning of 2020, the country was highly politicized already. In January, Trump had just gone through his second impeachment. So when the stock market crashed in anticipation of a pandemic on the horizon, many people claimed that it was a political hoax by the Democrats to undermine President Trump. And so that mindset got set with many people that COVID wasn't real. This is some kind of political hoax, which was a terrible tragedy because many of those people suffered badly and many died.
Right. I wonder if you could just take a moment to talk about Fox News' Tucker Carlson. This is something else that I do not remember knowing about at the time. I'm not even certain that I've heard of this even since until reading your book. And again, we're talking about your book, COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. It's very interesting what he had to say about this looming COVID pandemic.
Yes, I'll comment. And by the way, the references in the book are readily available to confirm those comments and his quotes. I would summarize Tucker Carlson as a contrarian. He likes to go against the grain. And the grain in the early 2020 timeframe regarding COVID was, oh, this is a political hoax, or it's no worse than the flu. It's not that serious. It's going to go away. So that was a common view in the first 3 months of 2020. Tucker Carlson basically disagreed with that. And on the air, he said, you've got to take this seriously. And furthermore, he arranged to have a three-hour meeting with President Trump at Mar-a-Lago, where he basically explained to Trump how serious he thought the pandemic was, and then went back on the air saying, folks, you've got to take this seriously. This is a killer. This is going to be a major pandemic. And incredibly, he said, you may have voted for somebody who said it wasn't serious, but he was wrong. It is serious. You have to take it seriously. That was Tucker Carlson.
Hmm. You tell us that even before March 13th, 2020, when President Trump declared a national emergency around this, you tell us that there were already people here in America, especially, who were working to cash in on this. You say within weeks of the outbreak, a mini industry had popped up selling fraudulent COVID cures. Can you just describe briefly what we're talking about here and the significance of it? I mean, to what extent this ended up being a significant factor in how serious things became?
Well, by February and early March, there were all kinds of quacks and people on social media selling solutions to cure or to stop COVID or cure COVID. And the book, I discuss a number of specific individuals. For example, Alex Jones with InfoWars was one of the leaders. He had a super blue toothpaste, and believably he said would actually cure COVID, and the FTC shut that down. Dr. Joseph McCullough here in Florida, where I live, was promoting vitamin cures, kind of like Robert Kennedy is doing for vitamin A and Bezos as a cure for COVID, and the FTC shut that down in the summer of 2020. So there are a lot of people basically promoting all kinds of homeopathic and other cures for COVID, both the symptoms and prevent COVID, which were just attempts to cash in on the panic at the time. And fortunately, the FTC shut that down pretty strongly. But then we had hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin come up as possible cures. And many people still believe ivermectin is a cure or treats COVID at least. And in my book, I point out 2 points I think really would discourage, I would think, people from believing that. First is Merck, which manufactures ivermectin, in January of 2021, after doing extensive clinical research, put a position paper out saying ivermectin will not treat the symptoms or prevent COVID. End of discussion. And they said it very clearly. But to me, even more interesting was the fact that India, which is a country of 1.6 billion people, a relatively poor country, had needed a solution for COVID, tried desperately to use ivermectin as a cure, and after 9 months, they put a position out in September of 2021 saying, ivermectin is useless against COVID. It does not treat the symptoms, and it does not cure or prevent COVID. End of discussion. So by then, I think most people had realized ivermectin really isn't effective, and the only real solution is vaccines, but today, some people still believe ivermectin works for COVID. It's just not true.
Wow. Well, of course, one of the key components to the national emergency that was declared was the lockdowns. And you describe the extent to which there were howls of protest all across the country, but especially in particular quarters. And of course, you freely acknowledge, and it's undeniable, that the lockdowns had a devastating effect on our nation's economy. But it is a bit disturbing to read about some of the events that were created to help ferment displeasure over these lockdowns. You tell us, for instance, about a rally held in Austin, Texas in early April, in which InfoWars host Alex Jones called for an end to the lockdowns, declaring, "Texas is leading the war against the tyrants." And, of course, the tyrants referring to people like Dr. Anthony Fauci. You examined this in pretty clear detail. Were concerns about these lockdowns springing up kind of where we might expect them to politically, more in so-called red states? Or did we see a lot of these protests and resistance, in a sense, across the country, despite any political leanings one way or another?
No, one of my greatest disappointments, Greg, in during the research in the book was how politicized the pandemic became. And unfortunately, conservative red states suffered many, many more deaths in general than the blue and liberal states did. And that was because of the belief. So early, like you point out, early in March of and early in April of 2020, Alex Jones, among many, basically claimed we're being managed by tyrants. We've got to resist this and restore our personal freedoms. And I completely support that. But you have to remember, in April, the death rate in the United States went up from virtually nothing, just a few hundred at most deaths in early, the end of March, to 70,000 COVID deaths by the end of April. So in 1 month, the deaths in COVID ballooned to more deaths than we had in all of Vietnam during the Vietnam War. So we weren't sure what we were dealing with, and if some people overreacted, which they perhaps did in retrospect, I think it's understandable, and they shouldn't be criticized. They should at least be given some understanding as to what they were dealing with at the time. People like Alex Jones was trying to generate interest and enthusiasm for his InfoWars site and selling vitamin supplements and that type of thing. And there were other people doing that. And that did, in my opinion, that was a major disservice to Americans.
What about the matter of when vaccines were developed and then made available to the general public? And again, there is this matter of resistance in some quarters. And of course, I think most of us know quite a lot about that portion of the American public that was skeptical and remains skeptical about vaccinations in general, and very much skeptical about the COVID vaccine specifically. How did that resistance manifest itself across the country, and what conclusions did you draw from what you discovered?
First of all, let me just say that the notion of vaccine hesitancy actually started in the summer and the early fall of 2020 by the Democrats, in particular Joe Biden, who said, I trust science, but I don't trust Donald Trump, and he's going to push vaccines quickly before they're ready. So he's the one that basically started that notion. And then that was picked up by a good part of the country. Surprisingly enough, Democrats didn't really endorse that or support that. But Republicans did, and they held on to that belief that the vaccines were still dangerous, experimental, and were released too quickly, which was a factor. But vaccines do work, and I just want to give you a discussion about how you can kind of determine that. I did an extensive analysis of the state of Texas, which had one of the highest death rates, had relatively high death rates in the country. And I analyzed two counties. I analyzed Midland County, in West Texas, in Travis County, which is the home of Austin, Texas, and the capital of Texas. Those counties are very, very similar in terms of their population, age levels, obesity levels, education, etc., except one county is strongly Republican, that's Midland County. One county is strongly Democratic, that's Travis County. And the death rates there were different by a factor of three, as well as were the vaccination rates, highly different, all based on politics, which was a tragedy that many people died based on their political beliefs.
One of the chief concerns you raise in your book is the whole matter of conspiracy theories, and we've kind of danced around that sad reality a bit already in this conversation. But I want to be sure to give you a chance to really talk about what you regard as the most serious conspiracy theories, and beyond what those theories sort of entailed, the damage that was done, the way in which those conspiracy theories and the way they were proffered undermined our national response to this crisis.
Well, I discussed those conspiracy theories in the chapter called Alternative Facts. And I point out that as early as May 2020, people were capitalizing on the pandemic by one group put out a video that was very popular at the time called Plandemic. And that's the conspiracy theory that the pandemic was started by Bill Gates with cooperation from Anthony Fauci to sell vaccines. And that was spread across social media by the millions and millions of copies. And so that set the mindset for many people about what the pandemic was about and the fact that the vaccines were really just something done that may actually be dangerous. One of the pandemic went through four videos, and later on in the second and third videos, they began talking about how the vaccines actually had tiny, tiny microchips in them, which were being tracking people through 5G cell towers. I mean, it was just crazy, crazy stuff that some people apparently fell for. I mean, that was one of the more damaging ones. Another one was by America's frontline doctors, who basically saying the vaccines don't work, the vaccines are dangerous. They can corrupt your whole DNA system, and ivermectin is the approach to treat COVID. And, of course, they sold ivermectin by mail order or over the Internet to people that wanted to buy ivermectin by just getting a prescription from a doctor talking on the telephone. So that did a lot of damage. Then, of course, there was RFK Jr., Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who had been for 20 years a vaccine skeptic and then basically went after the COVID vaccines with a vengeance and several times said the vaccine is more dangerous and is killing more people than COVID itself, an absolutely irresponsible statement.
I have to say that in that chapter, which is among the most compelling in the book, it is just so interesting. I found especially interesting and also in an odd way, maybe somewhat comforting, the long view that you give when it comes to conspiracy theories. That is, these kind of conspiracy theories are not something that first emerged during the COVID crisis. You talk about how the history of humanity is checkered with such conspiracy theories. You quote an expert who says, conspiracy theories give people quick, easily acceptable explanations for issues that otherwise have no simple answers or solutions. And for centuries, we have seen conspiracy theories spring up. It happened after the Spanish influenza. It happened during the Great Plague, and so on. It may be comforting is the wrong word, but maybe there's something at least sort of vaguely reassuring that this is just kind of part of our human condition, and this is not something unique to the modern age, to the digital age. That being said, the fact that we live in the digital age, I suppose, makes some of these conspiracy theories even more potentially dangerous because of the way in which they can be spread.
That's an interesting point. In my book, I talk about other pandemics, including the London Plague of 1665, which killed 100,000 people in a few months in London, and, of course, the Spanish flu. And the London Plague of 1665 was documented in a book by Daniel Defoe, the novelist who wrote Robinson Crusoe. But 60 years after the plague, he took his uncle's diary, which his uncle was in London at the time, and made a historical novel out of that. And he pointed out that in 1665, and he basically said the crazy ideas that we have today, namely in 1732, didn't really exist because they didn't have the newspapers like we have now in 1732. So he pointed out even then that conspiracy theories and misinformation spreads mainly through the media as opposed to word of mouth, although even during the 1665, there were different all kinds of misinformation about cures, for example, primarily about cures for the pandemic at the time, which were wrong and spread oftentimes by quacks trying to sell cures themselves. But then in 1918, just after the World War I, of which we were fighting the Germans, many of the conspiracy theories that popped up about the source of the flu were that the Germans had spread it, either by spreading it through submarines in Boston Harbor or through other means, and including Bayer Aspirin, which was owned by a German company, although it had an American subsidiary. One of the major theories was that Bayer Aspirin was spreading the Spanish flu in 1918 because it was a German country. I think people want to feel they have some control and some understanding of things that are dangerous and affecting them. And I think it's just like you point out, it's just natural human psychology to try to come up with an idea of what might be causing this. And that's where these theories come from.
The subtitle of your book refers to one of the most fundamental challenges in something like the COVID-19 pandemic. The subtitle is America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. And so that comes down to matters like somebody wearing a mask, even though they don't want to wear a mask, or somebody being forced to stay home from work when they want to be working, or somebody being asked to physically distance themselves when that's just something they do not want to do. What is your sense of whether or not we have made any progress in terms of coming to a better understanding and or consensus over this balancing act between the public good around health concerns versus a given person's personal freedom to live their lives the way they want to?
Well, I'd like to think we're learning from that, but I would like to say Americans are more than willing to sacrifice. We made huge sacrifices personally and in our personal freedoms during World War II, for example. People voluntarily joined services knowing they may be killed to fight for American freedom, for example. So we made huge sacrifices, but the difference there was we had an external enemy, the Germans and the Japanese. What happened with the pandemic? It wasn't external. We had no single thing we could point to other than a virus. And so as a consequence, people tended to think about what kind of sacrifices am I being asked to make with this kind of invisible enemy. And that was the difference. But we have to eventually learn that if we don't, for what I've said to people about this, if you don't trust the federal government, and this is where much of the division came from, people believed that the lockdowns weren't necessary. It wasn't that serious oftentimes. Then go to your personal physician, or we're blessed with some of the best medical institutions in the country, the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, Massachusetts General in Boston, the Cleveland Clinic, Stanford in California, great hospitals in Texas. Go listen to them. Check their websites and see what they say about vaccines or masks and take their advice. But I think if people understand what the threat really is, and that wasn't really the case during the pandemic, Americans are willing to make a sacrifice, but they have to really, really realize it's a true threat that's threatening them and not something that they may discount.
Hmm. The book, again, is COVID Wars, America's Struggle Over Public Health and Personal Freedom. And the author is Ronald Gruner. The book is published by Libertan Press. Ronald Gruner, thank you so much for your meticulous work on this important and complicated topic. And thank you for being my morning show guest. I really appreciate this opportunity to speak with you.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and I appreciate the conversation.
Tomorrow on the morning show, my guest is Dr. Art Sear, paying his monthly visit to the program. We will spend most of our time talking about the first several months of President Donald Trump's second term as president. On Wednesday, I will be welcoming to the studios Dr. Ron Kronovich, who is head of the economics department at Carthage. We will be looking at what is a tariff and what is behind the tariff increases proposed and implemented by President Trump, and what are their consequences for us and for the global economy.
The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock, and the problem with WGTD's morning show archive has been rectified, so you should be able to go to WGTD.org and find any recent interviews that you want to hear again. Again, at WGTD.org. Mostly sunny skies today and mild conditions, a high of 62 degrees. It will be windy, though, today, and some gusts up to 40 miles per hour. Partly cloudy and cold overnight with a 40% chance of rain after midnight and a low of 38. Sunny again tomorrow. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.